Yeah, and let's take a jump now to the fourth level you introduced us to, which is conscious energy. For me, this is a real game changer, and it's not about sitting in Zazen and meditating only. That can certainly build up our capacity, but how do you do that in real life? So the way I think of that is an organization operating at conscious level of energy recognizes that each person there, in each entity, each customer, each watershed they work with, has a way of being in the world. They have an identity of their own, and it's consistent with their own essence. And so, you family somehow makes everybody sons and daughters and aunts and uncles, and loses that connection with each entity has its own way of being in the world. There is a recognition when you get to conscious energy that the world we live in kind of has different levels of phenomena, di different strata that we can reach in terms of our ability to care, to take on something bigger, to be a part of a greater whole, and to bring that into our existence rather than the kind of collapsed version we have of making everyone the same. We did sense at automatic. But making everyone equal at sensitive as opposed to being able to see them as unique beings.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, I want to take a minute to acknowledge our listeners and subscribers. We love getting your reflections and the subjects you pose, but not all are fit for our format and purpose, while they are nonetheless still great ideas. We only do business topics and not government or policy subjects. We actually have to leave those for you to pursue. And we don't give first opinions, only second opinions on someone else's idea. We give you the source so you can think alongside us. We don't answer your questions or respond to your curiosities about what we think about a subject. Instead, we're exposing thinking gaps, not idea gaps. And we want you to learn to have a second opinion, not replace your current opinion with our opinion. If that happens, frankly, we failed in our work. So as a reminder, what we need from you are publicly available articles so we can have everyone read it and learn to question others thoughtfully and form your own opinion. It's not our ideas that matter. It's how we think. Our purpose is to teach the world how to be more discriminating about how they read and how to think about that content, to be rigorous in what we all accept and consider, and to stop our susceptibility to lower order, unexamined thinking, and to stop passing on offerings that divide us and dumb down our thinking about truly important subjects. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, as you know by now, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn how to work more closely with us, stay tuned to the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach. And speaking of discernment, which you just were, and what we read, we've got an article here today suggested by John Paul Maxfield, who was the founder of Waste Farmers. His request is for a second opinion on a subject, and I'm going to interpret what I think the question is that he's asking about, which is how cultures get built around emotional connections within the company or maybe with other people in different kinds of cultures. So actually, Zach, why don't you tell people the reference, how to find it, and what the New York Times article was from your perspective offering an opinion on?
Yes. Okay. So you all can find this from the July 17th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. And the article is entitled "Airbnb Was Like a Family Until the Layoff Started," by Aaron Griffith.
Yeah, and what do you see as the point of that article and the message that Aaron Griffin, who wrote the piece, what was she pointing to?
Yeah, okay, great. So my read was that she was illuminating the culture of Airbnb, and what she saw was inconsistencies between espoused values and practice values of the company. So for example, while they espoused values like belonging to their company, to their employees, they simultaneously had to fire 1,900 of them due to the crunch the travel industry experienced during the COVID-19 pandemic. In other words, She was aiming to examine the culture of Airbnb and what she perceived as conflicts between the business's need to survive versus its culture of wanting people to feel like they were in a family.
Yeah, family. Interesting word, isn't it? Why do you think we pursue cultures based on the idea of being like a family? I hear that quite a bit among people who are selling, various emotional intelligence kinds of things or alternatives to how it is we organize it. What makes people seek to be and offer to be a part of a family?
Yeah, I think my sense is that it all comes down to like talent and motivation, I think, if I were to distill it. It's like if you look at the technology and startup sectors in general, they kind of perceive themselves to be in a constant war for talent. And so they need to come up with kind of innovative ways to keep folks happy and motivated to grow in their companies in these really competitive spaces. So these companies differentiate themselves not only through their offerings, but most loudly they seem to do it through the cultures they espouse inside. And these cultures, whether about belonging or strong mission statements or what have you, as pointed out in the article, are really organized to keep people happy and excited to work there and also bring those folks in, almost in like an organic kind of way. And so these cultures are often contrasted against older, more industrial-driven models where everyone's kind of a number.
Yeah. You've heard me say this before, Zach, that, and I think this may be another case of that, where anything better than the bad management style people are experiencing and any practices they've come to hate is going to be the thing they want because they don't want the bad. And we see the reports over and over again. 70% of people are unmotivated, unhappy at work. I get so tired of reading that because I've seen that for 5 decades. People are desperate, Zach. And I know that this has been personal for you. You've left corporate America a couple of times, actually. Mm-hmm. What do you think is missing when you look at your experience there that people are running away from?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel it as a small business owner more. We recently had a conversation at work about our culture as well. So like how to recognize it, what culture means, how it works, and what its effects are. But more than that, I have this pretty strong desire to consciously build a company whose culture doesn't fall into the morass that others find themselves in. And I can definitely tell you that it's not easy. I know for us, I do my best to instill development as a core process and having us all reflect on the effects of how we work together as culture, rather than trying to work on culture directly through perks, for example.
Yeah, and I know you're trying to create something better. And I think what I was describing, heard this before, is it seems to be another example of what Herb Simon, who was a Nobel laureate economist, and he was building on Voltaire, the French philosopher's idea, is that we tend to settle for something better than the bad. Any good idea will be better than the bad. And the problem his economic theory was that it blocks us from being able to see a really best way, one that would be way beyond what we were conceiving of with just the better. So let's offer a way to people today to try and assess, quote, improvement ideas, like how you're going to keep talent, how you're going to keep people motivated, and be able to use that to assess the quality of energy that's being evoked in an organization when someone says, oh, let's be a family. Let's do that.
Yeah, I see a lot of value in a framework we use called levels of energy. So I think for today, we are going to use 4 levels of energy to help people assess different practices, programs, and cultures. So if you could, dear listener, visualize a ladder. And if you consider the lowest rung on order of energy on that ladder, that's what we call vital energy, which is all about survival or the most base energies that allow an entity to live. The next rung up from there is automatic, which is all about what we do unconsciously. I would say we are an automatic most of the time, whether it's how we brush our teeth, take a shower, or drive. Habits, in other words, live at the level of automatic. Next level up from there is sensitive, which considers our relationship to the external world and how we interact with it. And finally, conscious is how we use our mental capacity for reflection to be more connected to a larger purpose.
Yeah. I'm thinking How rare do we think about that? For those of you who are listening right now, it's probably not, even if you've heard us talk about it, something you pop into your mind very often. But mental energy is framing how we think about everything, how we make decisions, how we design programs and interventions to help our customers. Can you give us an example from your own life about how this looks when you move up this so-called ladder you just described?
Sure. I mean, I'll give you an example from a different time in my life. I guess we'll start there. So I think during my days on Wall Street, I considered most everything from a vital lens. So I was consumed almost completely with whether or not I was going to make my sales draw that month, for example. And as they would say back then, every month we started back at $0. So that basically had me living in a constant state of fear and panic. And so I instead decided to kind of try to level that up. At the time, it was unconsciously, by approaching things from an automatic level to try to structure my work better and organize myself. So I would put my sales calls in automatic, which was tracking some number of them every day between like 100 and 200, and not thinking about very much and just executing, right? Like picking a random number and just doing it. And so I think the next level up from there, which is the highest I'm pretty sure I ever got, was about being more sensitive to the needs of my clients. So this is where I was asking, you know, I was really asking them, like, what do they need and how can I deliver on it, right? And kind of trying to listen to them a little bit more. So I was in dialogue with them. And this took more time than the regular sales process. So I ended up with less clients and deeper relationships as a result. But in the end, I mostly used unconscious sensitive energy, if I could call that, to drive the competitiveness inside of our company. So it was more about the sensitivity that would happen in everyday interactions with other people at the on the desk. And so it was really like the Thunderdome in there, if I could use another analogy. And I didn't really reflect on anything back then and was conscious of very little, I would say.
And you're actually speaking to what happens when an organization is unvital. It becomes almost impossible for everyone. And you have to fight against the stream, so to speak, to even get to this kind of minimal level of sensitive energy to know what's around you. So let's take your story, your experience, and apply it now to a company like Airbnb in this article, the one JP sent us. When they were on vital, there's a tendency to keep people on edge. You described that. And worried about the future, theirs and the business. And everyone becomes concerned about its capacity for the business to stay alive. And that internal energy speaks to the loss of hope and or hope for recovery, which once we're stuck there, it's very hard to get out.
Yeah. And I would say, like, at this level, the energy of people gets diverted from their normal tasks and instead focus on whether or not they'll be considered vital to the organization, right? Am I going to get fired? Are we going to exist? And so work is not really a primary concern anymore. Instead, energy is focused on who and what's going to get dropped or who and what's going to be allowed to stay. And so my experience of how that happens, or my experience of how it happened, works and feels is frankly really detrimental. So like when I worked on Wall Street, I ate really unhealthy. I ate too much. I drank too much. I never slept and was constantly trying to self-medicate in order because I was feeling so anxious all the time. And so I see the Airbnb story falling into vital here, right? So with the pullback of the travel market, the founders fell into vital energy to try to survive. And as Mr. Chesky says, one of the founders who stayed in the article, he said, you know, quote, you're in a house, it's burning, and you have to put out the fire while getting the furniture out of the house and also rebuilding the house. This is like a prime example of the mindset of kind of vital energy at work, where one thinks one's very existence and its life or death is at stake.
You know, I'm thinking as I listen to you, what Airbnb was doing initially with inviting people into a family was really inviting them into sensitive energy. Pay attention to how we feel about you, concerns we have for all of you. But when the market collapsed as a result of COVID, the decisions from the leadership team fell into vital. They don't know whether they're going to survive. They were about to go public. Are they going to be able to do that? And the whole process collapses down to what you described. The vital is very polarizing. Who survives and who doesn't? And of course, they wiped out whole teams, and people said, are we next? So these things and the people in them that they were dealing with, from what looked like, you know, indirect, we have no control, long term, we're going to be devalued, all of that shot people into the short term and into trying to figure out how to manage the value that was disappearing. So it all became us against them. The employees in this case were one department against another, and ultimately they were all collapsed into vital.
Yeah, so I mean, to your point, they did things like set up war room calls with investors, which is a quote from the article, change their refund policies, which really kind of hurt the people who were putting their homes up, but tried to help the people that were stuck in these kind of really tricky predicaments from COVID. And they also cut like 490 full-time freelancers, who they also referred to as family. And all seemingly based on this vital level of energy that was driving thinking. They also shelved these ideas like stakeholder capitalism, which was driving a larger purpose within the company, right? And this is all topped off by Mr. Chesky's desire to end up, quote unquote, on the right side of history. Another example of polarized thinking.
Yeah. You know, I bet many of our listeners have been in companies, whether it's during COVID or earlier, where something has changed. The market's changed, the industry's changed, the financial exchange rate. And what you get is a sudden experience of vital energy at the top of the organization with a cascade down. And you experience everyone trying to survive, and they become more assertive. They often are very divisive. Whose team are you on? Are you with me or against me? And people are increasingly ordered and directed in regard to what functions that they are supposed to engage in. Bounded by, am I supposed to do this, not do that? You can no longer have people thinking for themselves. You're carrying out your function, which you think is kind of minimal to stay in the job. And the will of the organization is very excitable. So you have any change like the shutdown of this group you spoke to and layoff of some contractors. And what you have is people become hypersensitive, trying to deal with the circumstances. So accountability really no longer is held by each individual person. They put the accountability external outside of them and try to feel like, how can they survive in this situation?
Yeah, and I definitely recognize that in my own life as well, right? I'm not saying that I'm above any of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
These are real forces that are at work, right? So when COVID hit our company, the email stopped, the phone stopped ringing, the whole thing, right? Dead silence. And there was a week there where every day it was battle stations ready, right? I'd drink a gallon of coffee and stand in front of my computer, and I'd read the Johns Hopkins infection dashboard and every news outlet I could answer for. And so after about like three migraines and a couple panic attacks, I stopped doing that because I was actually able to see the effect my own thinking was having on me.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of the best you feel like you can do when you get in those is you start exhorting people to, we have to work harder together, we're pep talk, we're all going to be fine, we'll figure it out. And that's the good part, right? But sometimes there are the threats, like we're going to have to lay people off, castigating people who are not really providing the leadership they should. So if you read this article, you can see everything we just described here going on.
Yeah, in my new startup, with my new employees and relationships, I definitely felt the need to do this as well. Many pep talks to myself and my crew. But again, realizing that pep talks don't do very much or get me or anyone else very far beyond getting us to the starting line. So instead, we would start having conversations with clients, seeing what they were wrestling with, seeing what they were thinking about, seeing how things were moving in their world to try to actually better be connected to the work that we were trying to do rather than so internally focused.
And you're speaking to beginning to move up to try and put something on automatic that keeps us out of vital.
Yep.
Do this, do that, get a list. And we begin to notice that we can't shift how we're feeling about things. And as organizations expect everything to kind of be in place, have an order, get it done on automatic, you can feel the energy shift. Oh yeah, we're kind of machine at work again. But you do begin to feel like all the procedures you're setting up prevail over people. In experiencing the energy of the organization, it begins to feel more machine-like. And in some ways, that feels so much better than the vital, but it also kind of lacks personality. How does this play out, or how do you see it having played out in Airbnb?
I see that playing out here with a core assumption that affects not only Airbnb, but many other companies and people as well. So once you get a repeated process in place, they really begin to calcify, right? Just like habits. And this works well to take the thinking out of repeatable tasks, but it disables the capacity for complex thinking when the market shifts or things begin to deviate. And so in Airbnb's case, they had expanded other business lines and they put them on automatic without considering the implications of that growth during a pullback. And the effects of this were they needed to automatically cut drastically across the company, seemingly more across financial and structural boundaries than anything else, which is, I think, why so many people were really frustrated and upset.
Yeah. And, you know, on automatic, the decision process really gets focused on any variance because now we can't be on automatic and on getting them corrected quickly. And the behavior of the people becomes what we respond to, and particularly their behavior and their functional work, what their checklist and their list of work to do is. People begin to largely feel like they have to leave their being behind and only bring their hands and the work that it's concerned about. Their state of being doesn't matter when you're on automatic. I mean, it's alive and vital, but it's not very directed. Being gets kept out of things when you're in the automatic version of business interaction. So leadership for an automatic state is often, it's like repeatable. It's generic, nothing specific. Like you don't notice the people around. You don't even notice who you're making the product for. It's follow the procedures. And often there are incentives and rewards to keep people on track and the kind of role modeling. See, we're giving them a national award. Be like them. And then for those who don't respond well on automatic, there's a lot of punishment. So being on automatic is kind of soulless, I think.
Yeah, and I see that, right? If you look at the article, there's this moment where they talk about cutting the safety team internally at Airbnb.
Right.
And this team was intended to support issues with rentals that included like shootings and assaults and all these other kind of things. And that team was hit during the cuts. And Airbnb had to end up rehiring a bunch of those folks in order to work through a bunch of cases that had ended up piling up. And this also happened to their regulatory response and payment teams as well, right? So it's like on automatic, it's like you lose this kind of critical thinking capacity to make the appropriate kind of decisions, and you just start hacking and slashing.
Yeah. You know, when I think about what Airbnb was seeking to do at the beginning, is they knew what you just described, kill soul. They didn't want that kind. They'd all worked there. Mm-hmm. And so what they wanted to do is create a culture of what we would describe here at the next level, for you did, is sensitive energy cultures where the organization operates where relationships become central. And there's an expectation that we'll pay attention to people, their origins, their gender will be paid attention to. There's a level of awareness and even a level of caring in such an organization that doesn't exist when you have that automatic machine-like, get it all done right, get it corrected when you need to. But there's also a focus on feedback, where there starts to be more people telling one another what they think, speaking directly, with some thought that somehow that openness is the right thing to do. And it leaves people, though, to not examine what the system is, how it's working, people undeveloped, and all really trying to move people around a bit like chess pieces on a board just by behavior.
And unfortunately, that seems to be what they had really aspired to, right? They showed up with their slogans on the walls about belonging and to the executive team, you know, where they talk about giving a standing ovation to the people they let go. In my experience, this level of energy is predominantly where most of their ideas for how to shape the culture were sourced from. And the issue with sensitive energy is that it can often just turn internally focused too much instead of maintaining this external focus with clients and stakeholders.
Right. And So we've been talking about how the decision process changes. The decision process at Vital is one of panic. At Automatic, you're just trying to get it chunking along, and it's sensitive. What you're really trying to do is carry out and maintain some kind of behavior standard, how people are with one another, what they believe about inequality and issues which concern all of us, but they become primary to the organization on sensitive. And each decision works against some clear articulation of goals involved in that. Like, we really want to increase our consideration of this or that. And usually it's related to making sure people are paying attention to one another at a level you don't on Automatic, because there's no differentiation. So I think, generally speaking, the members of our organization on sensitive energy are pretty well schooled in kind of the guidelines about how members relate to one another, and their conversations that are designed to course correct that relationship work, which is different than the task work. But it also has challenges, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, right? I think it seems that Airbnb spoke to this level with the family metaphor, but was missing some of the practices needed to make it work, right? So you can see this showing up in examples from the article about Airbnb's treatment of firing contractors and the sexual harassment claims that emerged from within the company at the time.
Yeah, it seems like perhaps the language that they were using to be sensitive relationships was really in some ways becoming more Automatic, trying to drive it home. And the procedures were still all being prescribed from a hierarchical point of view, a benevolent one, but here's how you treat family members and passing all that down.
And people operating at a sensitive level of energy have intentions which are not evident in this article. Right? They were more relating to one another rather than to their customers and stakeholders, which left them vulnerable since they were not serving the market and the stakeholders, but one another.
That's a really important point. And I find lots of organizations which aspire to be more family-like, more caring for one another, the gender, the concerns of what we create socially, can get lost on paying attention to the members in their organization, rather than what all those people are being of service to, and how they do it is care for one another. But if it's all external, if it's all internally, it leaves us not paying attention to the external. There is one aspect of sensitive, which is being accountable for managing the intention of fairness across the system. And I've seen many companies, including this one, where when things don't work and you fall to Vital, and the work ends up being unfairly distributed, it leads to a series of problems. So leadership at this level concerned often start with, you hear terms like creating psychological safety. You now know they're at a sensitive energy level and they're at risk because you can't create psychological safety and coaching people and their behavior when the market collapses, when things fall to Vital. So anyway, I think there's still too much of the authoritarian role. And you could see that the family has a benevolent father who suddenly was not very valued.
Right. And what's needed is a move away from role-to-role engagements, boss to subordinate, for example, to self-to-self, where the work is the focus. So conversations become concerned with what's needed as a team or as a partner or a collective to do about a given situation, guided by managing principles, of course, but then as they're a guide for the reflection as seen above. Right? There's an avoidance of sharing personal feelings and expectations of others, and instead replaced by more self-reflection based on development principles rather than behavioral and humanistic principles.
Yeah, and let's take a jump now to the fourth level you introduced us to, which is conscious energy. For me, this is a real game changer, and it's not about sitting in Zazen and meditating only. That can certainly build up our capacity, but how do you do that in real life? So the way I think of that is an organization operating at a conscious level of energy recognizes that each person there in each entity, each customer, each watershed they work with has a way of being in the world. They are, have an identity of their own, and it's consistent with their own essence. And so you, family somehow makes everybody sons and daughters and aunts and uncles, and loses that connection with each entity has its own way of being in the world. There is a recognition when you get to conscious energy that the world we live in kind of has different levels of phenomena, different strata that we can reach in terms of our ability to care, to take on something bigger, to be a part of a greater whole, and to bring that into our existence rather than the kind of collapsed version we have of making everyone the same. We did sense at automatic, but making everyone equal at sensitive as opposed to being able to see them as unique beings.
Yeah, so for example, the organization is in an ongoing development process, right? Where they are learning about their own behavior and how to bring the personal essence expression into their work. They learn to examine the history of the business and the volatility of markets and world forces. And they're also stewards that watch and study restraining forces, like world-changing forces. And they're in teams and have stewardship for the organization, not at the mercy of beneficent leaders who will take care of them as a loving father. The family metaphor is seen as fostering dependence and external locus of control at the end of the day.
The thing that's been, I think, the greatest joy to me in the companies that I've worked with as an educator for thinking and for consciousness is that you build a very different way of working. So everyone feels stewarding for the crazy world we live in. You create work so that everyone has a connection to the outside world and is bringing in all those changes. And therefore, no one is surprised by the outside forces. No one would think that it's the father's job to take care of everyone, because you have teams and you have work designed in a way that draws everyone into being responsible for the management of the business, for preparing to deal with the ups and downs of the market and whatever is going on with the global and local forces and volatility. It's not a hierarchy's responsibility. Instead, the decision process that is constantly everyone holding themselves accountable for and shared responsibility on managing the energies that are at work. So if that's your point of view, you don't have someone trying to take care of others and create a family. Instead, you're always building capability to be able to see and understand global forces, how they're going to affect your business, designing for how you're going to work and be structured to manage in up and down times. So, Zach, how are you aspiring to work this way as your company grows? And how are you building capability for this? And by the way, why is that important?
I mean, I rely on my team members to be self-managing and aware of the same external forces that I'm focused on, right? And so we don't silo information inside the organization. Instead, we think and work together on what's moving in the markets in which we're nested. And this is all underpinned by development through conscious reflection.
So the decision process, if I'm understanding you right, that you're working toward, is being able to have decisions made that are based on everyone having a different strata of understanding that needs to be worked on. Like, there's no hierarchy of one group is responsible and the next group is responsible for them and the next one is higher. But instead, everyone is saying, do I understand all the stratas from the local to the global, from strategic thinking to operations? Do I have all of that in a way that I am helping be a part of setting direction? And it's not limited. The direction is not limited to coming from one source. Our income doesn't come from one source, from one path. Intrinsically, we begin to see that we have to require ourselves, and we build a culture that requires ourselves to work on these higher order ablenesses. I often tease people and say, everyone thinking like a CEO and having greater understanding of the working of reality. Extrinsically, we begin to see this requiring our ability to generate images and patterns of what it's like if we operate in different scenarios, in different circumstances, and make that a part of our planning process so we all can do things out of conscience and conscientiousness.
The behavior of conscious organizations is the sum total of all the work done to produce something of higher value and to provide all members of that ecosystem with the ability to engage in meaningful work. They tend to the people and events with equanimity and acceptance, and they have the character and will that seeks to redeem the earth and life upon it for the future.
I want to give a quick little story out of Kingsford Charcoal. Kingsford, we built, which had 13 facilities producing and a bunch of contractors, and knew that as we became incredibly productive, we would end up down at about 6 facilities. So we were in a different choice point, but we worked with Kingsford and with Clark's, the parent company, and said, we'd like to design these kind of changes over time so that everyone involved comes out better. And Clorox and Kingsford supported everyone who worked inside of the company, either creating their own business in the small towns, because we didn't want to devastate those, that would do import replacement. In other words, build business that people were driving 100 miles to get or 50 miles and make it available locally, including sending people back to school if they needed to for degrees or certifications. That whole process kept the company running a top notch, even in, and by the way, this was all in a couple of very down markets, but there was the principle in place that no one would be laid off until they had the same or a better job. And they were able to do that because they had put in place everyone knowing the story years literally in advance, months in advance, even when the sudden housing recession hit what we were doing and crashed markets for, well, just about everything that we consume, the principle stayed in place. And no one had said, we're a family, we'll take care of you. These were teams that were made up of operating people, suppliers, everyone who was looking and watching how we had to guide. And they were the ones that came up with the principle. No one is laid off until they have the same or better ability to contribute and earn. I think getting rid of the family metaphor could be a really good thing for Airbnb to consider now. What do you think?
I mean, I think Airbnb is a great case study for our times. And the lessons I'm taking away are, as always, you know, our companies are not edifices to greatness or competitive winner-take-all games. They're platforms for development. And everything is grist for the mill. And the harder the shock, the more it invites us to engage and find a path forward to continue to stay in meaningful relationships with the world around us.
Yeah. So on that note, the idea that they are all opportunities for development, everything that happens inside and outside, I invite anyone who would be interested in joining us to consider checking on the Regenerative Life Project and the Regenerative Media Company, where we're going to be doing work with parenting, but also every role inside of a company. If you're on our email list, you'll get notice about it. If you want to know more, send an email to carol@carolsanford.com.
We have several new learning communities to do this kind of thinking starting in 2021 and 2022. If today's show intrigued you, it was sparked by one of our members of our regenerative business communities. So the second year is about leadership, including leadership of change in one's business or organization or an industry. So check out the different business communities at carolsanfordinstitute.com under offerings.
And specifically, I mentioned that we are looking at the new community for parenting, where people can join in couples, in family pods, which would mean people even beyond the immediate family, that organize around the same children, that is, and community pods, where we'll have multiple family pods coming and learning and growing together. All that will be launched in October with an introductory session and then hopefully building to over 100 members in the organization.
And your organization can actually sign up for a book club for the Regenerative Life using an extensive workbook and video online workshops for free. And there's also 50% discounts on bulk buys through Carol's publisher. You can find out more at carolsanford.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.